Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Okay, here is a serious question. Are we set up right, government-wise, to get this economy through this crisis? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 22nd day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with two items. One of city government, one of state government from a federal official, all in pursuit of an answer to this question. Are we doing this right? Item one, the budget for the city of Los Angeles released earlier this week by Mayor Eric Garcetti. Austerity is a word that comes to mind. Deep cuts in city services, tens of thousands of furloughs, all, of course, a reflection of this coronavirus economy. Item two, an interview that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell gave this morning in which he said he would prefer that states that run into financial trouble because of the virus file for bankruptcy protection rather than count on aid from the federal government. So, given those two items, it seemed to us maybe this was a good day to talk states and cities and the federal government and how this economy can best work things out. To do that, we've called Jenna Bednar. She is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Do me a favor, and I don't want to get all into federalism and everything here, but lay out the relative levels of responsibility of the federal government and state governments in a crisis like this.
Well, ideally, or what we're seeing right now? I mean, ideally, right? Look, there's an awful lot that the states can and should be doing on their own. But there are things that they can't do without federal assistance, and there are things that the federal government is just naturally better at doing. But it really is a joint effort between the federal government and the state governments.
Right. So let's get to the money of this thing. As you know, the National Governors Association wrote yesterday to leaders in Congress saying we need, I think the number was $500 billion to stave off a shortfall. My sense is that when regular people begin feeling this, they will feel a shortcoming from state governments, right? Everything from unemployment insurance to PPE and all of that.
The PPP, exactly. Right. So there is an awful lot of money now that's been opened up for relief to individuals and to small businesses. But the missing piece is the federal government assisting the states, because unemployment is not going to go away. So while people are unemployed, they're relying on the social safety net that we've all invested in through our taxes. And it's really the states who are at the front lines of providing that, providing welfare, providing subsidies in health insurance, providing subsidies to higher education, because applications tend to go up as the economy goes down, because people think, oh, this might be a good time for me to go back to school. So there are many ways that state governments have to be involved if we're going to have a complete recovery.
All right. So I've been dancing around this question on the program for like a week now, and I haven't maybe framed it the right way, but this seems like a moment. Given that state governments are on the pointy end of the sword of this thing, is it possible that this crisis could get bigger than a state government's ability to fix it, if that makes sense?
It does make sense. If we don't think about assisting the states at the same time that we help to assist small businesses and individuals, we're going to have an incomplete recovery or a much longer recovery than we otherwise would have. And so in that sense, yeah, by the federal government not taking the lead here, I think it is out of the capacity of any single state acting on its own, or even, you know, even with these PACs that we're starting to see, Great Lakes, Western and Eastern, those are fantastic efforts, but they just don't have the same capacity that the federal government has. They cannot finance this. They can't borrow their way through this crisis.
Jenna Bednar is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan, where she studies, among other things, state governments. Professor Bednar, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
This economy is going to reopen eventually, unevenly probably, sooner in some places than in others. And things are going to look different, right? Restaurant tables are going to be spaced 6 feet apart. Masks, hopefully everywhere. Touchless payment systems, one hopes, the norm. And for the tens of millions of people who work desk jobs, a different kind of office space as well. From the Workplace Culture Desk Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Ramon Peralta heads his own creative agency, Peralta Design, in Shelton, Connecticut, and he's always taken pride in his stylish headquarters.
You know, beautiful office campus, glass conference room, you know, all the amenities.
And of course, the popular open floor plan, newly imbued with a sense of danger.
We may consider doing some plexiglass dividers, you know, or kind of cough shields, if you will.
Workstations facing each other might be turned apart, the fun game room repurposed into a solo office, and the whole space will get more frequent and deeper cleanings when his team eventually returns. Some workers have already returned to offices in China run by commercial real estate company Cushman & Wakefield. Despina Katsakakis has been helping put together best practices for their U.S. operations using their China experience as a model.
Infrared temperature checks, changing the way you access the building so you're not really touching any aspect of it. Voice-activated elevators.
And another thing, buildings will need to improve their airflow, says Joseph G. Allen, a professor at Harvard and author of the book Healthy Buildings. If windows can be opened, they should.
But you bring in more outdoor air and you dilute anything that's in the indoor air. And of course, if you partner that with enhanced filtration, you can actually capture virus particles and other particles.
He says current ventilation systems were designed for energy efficiency rather than to promote health. So they'll need to be adjusted to bring in more air. But maybe the biggest change will be workers who don't want to return to the office, which creative agency director Ramon Peralta is preparing for.
For us and for our culture, health is number one. And if they don't feel comfortable coming in, they won't have to.
Of course, allowing workers to stay home for the long term isn't something every company can do. And there are plenty of workers itching to get back to the office. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
You know what I haven't talked about yet today? Oil. It is still a bit crazy in the oil patch, but not upside down anymore. On Wall Street today, it was all upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Oktoberfest has been canceled. The Bulls are not going to be running in Pamplona this July. Festivals and events are being canceled right and left, and the list just keeps getting longer. Back here, South by Southwest went away last month. The annual Film, Music, and Technology Conference was a regular on the calendar for tens of thousands of people, which made it a very real economic necessity for a whole lot of Austinites. Marketplace's Andy Euler caught up with some of the people he interviewed last month to see how they're holding up now.
About 20 miles west of downtown, Byron Mowry, owner of Graphics Guys, commutes into an all but empty office every day. Before the crisis, his business wrapped vehicles and walls with promotional material for things like movies and concerts. Now he's producing different stuff.
Fortunately, we found a way to stay essential by making these new social distancing signs. You know, we're still open banners. Please wash your hands.
He says business is down 70% from last year. He laid off almost all of his staff, and now he's doing most of the work solo. He's applied for every piece of government assistance available, something very new for him.
I've been self-employed for over 20 years and never had to ask for any type of money from the government, so this is a very awkward situation.
On the east side of town, Brent Underwood isn't worried about how awkward the situation is. He applied for help from the government immediately. He owns and operates a 20-bed hostel, HK Austin.
Because we only have one full-time employee, we got $1,000, which certainly is appreciated, but doesn't really put that big of dent in our monthly expenses.
Particularly since he has no bookings right now. For the past month, he says the hostel has been empty. His mortgage payment on the property is a considerable expense, but he says the bank is deferring his mortgage payments for 3 months, and that'll help keep his hostel afloat for a little while. Even so,
I don't think people are going to start traveling or particularly staying in rooms with multiple beds anytime soon, so the future months is going to be interesting for sure.
Interesting is one way to put it, but when 29-year-old bartender Elizabeth Mathis thinks about how she's getting by, a different word altogether springs to mind.
Unemployment.
She filed for benefits a month ago, the same day she found out that Javelina, the bar she worked at on Austin's Rainy Street, was closing its doors. The unemployment office got back to her within 48 hours, letting her know she was going to get food stamps on top of unemployment pay.
So, like, I'm able to pay all my bills. And luckily my landlord is like super like kind and like understanding. And he was like working with me that like if I needed to like pay in payment.
She's been spending her time taking pictures and painting, trying to build up an art portfolio. Ultimately, she wants a job in the arts. Bartending, she says, was just a way to pay the bills. But she admits she can't wait to get back behind the bar if and when things begin to normalize. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
These would seem, on the face of it, to be heady days for companies that can pipe hour after hour of content to your devices to help kill time during or simply distract from these weeks and months of quarantine. And to some degree, they are, but there is also some peril here. Case in point, Netflix. It said today that it's going to issue another $1 billion in debt to keep buying and making more of the content we are all counting on right now. Borrowing money's not new for Netflix, right? But with the crisis still in its early days, is it sustainable, do you suppose? Marketplace Jasmine Gars has that one.
If there's a deep dent in your couch from all the Netflix watching during quarantine, you're not alone. After many quarters of slow growth, the company announced its new subscribers are double what was expected. But even CEO Reed Hastings cautioned against reading too much into that. Tim Hanlon from the media consulting company Vertere Group agrees.
Even Reed Hastings said in his call today, he expects those numbers to be relatively short-lived and will sort of tamp down as the virus plays out and people start to go back outside again.
There are more streaming platforms than ever trying to tap into that captive quarantine audience. Meanwhile, Netflix has already lost marquee shows like Friends and will soon lose The Office. And so it's been pivoting more to original content.
Carol Baskin, you've already stripped me of just about everything I own.
It's been hit or miss, but producing a successful show like Tiger King costs more money up front than licensing an old sitcom. Rahul Talang with Carnegie Mellon University says investors understand that.
At the end of the day, this business is going to be who can make the show that people are willing to pay for.
Netflix's debt has always raised eyebrows, but with the pandemic, it's hardly the only streaming service making investors concerned. Consider its competitor, Disney. Eric Hagstrom is an analyst with eMarketer.
Their parks are shut down or live sports are canceled right now, which is bad for ESPN, which is also owned by Disney.
Netflix's cash burning might seem risky, but at least they don't have a bunch of empty roller coaster rides and canceled sports events to worry about. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's too soon that I have to mourn the loss of my business, and hopefully I don't have to.
Hopefully not. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 456 points today, 1.9%, 23,475. The NASDAQ up 232 points, that's about 2.8%, 84.95 there. The S&P 500 banked 62 points, about 2.2%, 27.99. So, Netflix, as Jasmine was talking about, the investors not too enthusiastic. Shares dropped 2.8% today. AT&T, which owns HBO, shed 1.3% on the day. Bond prices, well, they fell. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 0.61%. And you are listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The coronavirus cares nothing for your business model. For profit, not for profit, no matter, revenues are drying up. But for those nonprofits, donations had been declining even before the crisis hit, and now it's getting worse. And so financial literacy groups, expecting ever greater demand for their services as unemployment rises, are out there looking for new pots of money in surprising places. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that one.
Joseph Lightman Santa Cruz is working 10-hour days right now. He's head of Capital Area Asset Builders, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that offers low-income residents free financial coaching. They've seen a 25% increase in phone calls and emails from laid-off restaurant workers and construction workers asking for advice on
what should be paid first, what can be put on hold,
what can be negotiated,
and what kind of conversations our clients need to have either with landlords or with debt collectors.
Lightman Santa Cruz has 9 employees, but he's the only Spanish speaker. He'd like to hire more bilingual financial coaches, but he doesn't have the money. So he joined more than 200 other nonprofits focused on financial literacy who sent a letter to the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau asking it for help. Dara Duguay, CEO of the nonprofit Credit Builders Alliance, is spearheading the letter campaign.
So I really think that this is the solution, at least to the immediate crisis that nonprofits are experiencing.
The nonprofits want the CFPB to dip into its $1.2 billion civil penalty fund and pay for some financial literacy work. The fund comes from fines companies pay after the CFPB penalizes them for defrauding consumers. Former CFPB Director Richard Cordray says that money is intended for victims of financial fraud, and the CFPB is still tracking victims down for payment.
If you take money out of the fund for this purpose, you're taking it away from victims. That would be the issue.
The CFPB didn't respond to our request for comment. On its website, the agency says it can use leftover money for financial literacy if it can't find victims. Cordray says the CFPB did contract with one nonprofit for financial counseling for veterans, but he says the billion-dollar fund shouldn't be drained for programs like that. Otherwise, there may not be enough for future victims, say if a company defrauds consumers, then goes bankrupt and can't pay fines. Quadri says financial literacy work is important, but
they should be funded by the federal government, by the state government, and by the local government.
But state and local governments are strapped for cash because revenue from sales and income taxes has plummeted, and the federal Paycheck Protection Loan Program for small businesses is out of money. More money is expected soon in the next aid package, but that'll be used up quickly. And Dara Duguay at Credit Builders Alliance still hasn't heard back from the CFPB. She says nonprofits are stuck.
Many of them, if they don't get additional funds, are not going to be able to quite literally exist anymore. And the services that they provide will disappear.
Or be cut back dramatically by those who survive. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
In the before time, so like 2 months ago, right? The economy was doing pretty well. Wages were on the rise. Unemployment was low. Consumers were pretty confident. What we weren't doing as an economy was saving, a reality that's coming to stark contrast now that the bottom's fallen out. America is no beacon of frugality, but savings rates here used to be a whole lot higher till they started dropping in the 1980s. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He has written about why that is so. Derek, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you as well.
Have there been policy decisions made by the government that sort of made it easy not to save, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, I do think there's a few things the U.S. does that makes it easy not to save. I think one thing we do is strongly encourage home ownership. I think a lot of people, especially in the bottom 50%, the vast majority of their wealth is tied up in their homes. The other thing is that, you know, the United States has moved from a sort of defined benefit retirement plan structure to defined contributions like 401ks. We don't take as much money out of people's paychecks to put into a social security system as other countries do. So as a result, you put it all together, I do think that there are some specifically American laws that make us uniquely less likely to save money.
There's a cultural piece too, right? And I don't know, frankly, whether this applies in a lot of other countries, but there is a keeping up with the Joneses thing in this country for sure. There's conspicuous consumption. I mean, there's a lot of that cultural spend money stuff.
Yeah, I do think that for a variety of reasons, both cultural and economic, Americans are uniquely susceptible to conspicuous consumption. One possibility here, an economic possibility, is that this is all about inequality. Lots of things are really expensive, and the bottom 40% just can't afford essentials like healthcare and education. Another possibility that is more cultural rather than economic is that for a variety of reasons, people here are just much more likely to demonstrate our wealth by spending it on essentially luxury items. And this isn't just something that rich people do. In fact, it's even more sometimes something that a middle-class person does because a middle-class person is more interested in showing that they're keeping up with the Joneses precisely because they're not. And so when you put it together, maybe inequality and marketing is intertwined and it's encouraging people to spend a lot and save very little.
This has been the case for, as you say, a number of decades now, but it does seem to be coming into stark relief as we all face this crisis at the same time. The idea that inequality is a matter of literally life and death, and ability to save and weather through this depends on how much money you have in the bank.
Yeah, and I do think the solution here is probably federal. There's lots of other countries that understand that federal governments are the insurance company of last resort. And so I think that one thing that this crisis is showing America is that one reason why it might be uniquely susceptible to a calamity like a pandemic is because we have this rugged individualism strewn throughout American culture where everyone wants to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and go it alone. Well, you can't go it alone in a public health crisis. A public health crisis requires a public solution.
All right. So look, having studied the history of this as you have, think back to the Great Depression. A generation came out of that much more savings-minded than we are in this country today. Do you think that applies come, you know, 2022 when we're through this thing?
It absolutely could. You know, you could see individuals saving more. You could see businesses stocking more away so that they have larger cash reserves if something like this happens again. But there's something else that happened during the Great Depression. It's not just that Americans started saving more. We also invented this little thing called Social Security. And Social Security reduced the poverty rate among American seniors from about 50%, which is just shocking to the conscience, to today about 9%. What that tells me is that, you know, Americans might be good at saving or they might be bad at saving, but you know who's really good at saving is the federal government through a forced savings protocol called Social Security. Mm-hmm. So maybe one thing that we should do is to force similar kind of savings through higher taxes on people that we redistribute through stronger social welfare, whether it's stronger Social Security, universal health care, or things like guaranteed family leave.
Derek Thompson, he's a staff writer at The Atlantic, writing a number of years ago now in the magazine about this issue, savings in America, but uniquely relevant today. Derek, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The now empty Paycheck Protection Program, set to be replenished this week, was to help small businesses not have to fire people. That fund ran out of money. Millions of small businesses weren't able to get any loans. And now business owners, those that got loans and those who didn't, are dealing with a slew of tough questions and some difficult decisions.
My name is Ulvia Nasebova. I own a gelato store, Gelateria Uli, in Los Angeles. It's very strange right now because we have to walk this fine line between protecting jobs and ensuring that our people can still go into work, but also keeping them safe and healthy. My job, as I see it, is to say, hey, if you want the hours, I'm giving them to you regardless of business being able to bring in the revenue or not because of GoFundMe / government assistance. So what do I do when people say, I don't want to get my family member sick? It is irresponsible of me to go into work right now. I can't force people to work. and I'm not going to. I had this American dream as an immigrant coming to the United States at the age of 17. And now it just feels like it's too soon that I have to mourn the loss of my business. And hopefully I don't have to. But there's a pretty big possibility that, you know, in a couple of months, I might not be able to keep it up.
That was Uli Nasibova there. She's the owner of Gelateria Uli, two locations here in Los Angeles. This final note on the way out today, super quick because we're tight on time. You're looking for a barometer on when things get back to normal? Here's one. Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian said in a company-wide memo today, he figures the recovery is going to take 2 to 3 years. All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrial's up 456 points today, 1.9%. NASDAQ up 232, that's 2.8%. S&P 500 banked 62 points, 2.2% there. Our media production team, and again, these are the ones going into the office, so the rest of us don't have to. They are Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, J.C. Bold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.